This is tape two of the Dr. Gordon Guyer interview. We were talking when the tape last ended about his term as president of the university and also the transition to the new president, Dr. McPherson.
Well, you know, Jeff, we were talking about how sometimes it's difficult to recruit outstanding people. And we mentioned, I don't remember if I was on the search committee, but it doesn't make any difference. I was on several of those for Mackey, but so we said it had gotten down to people getting restless because decisions weren't made. And I forget who it was that went to Texas and saw Mackey or somebody brought up, and he came back, one of the trustees, and said, let's take a look at him, and all at once he was president. Mm-hmm. And then with Peter, it was sort of interesting because they had gone through a lot of good names and hadn't made any decisions, and again, people start to get restless, and I guess, actually, Joel Ferguson and I had a little visit, and I said, how come you overlooked Peter McPherson? I said, I'd known his father and the family, and I thought quite highly of him, and I still do and think it was great. But they reviewed that again, and all at once, Peter was our president, which was a good decision. So picking presidents is sometimes it's a challenge, but both of those took that same route.
The President DiBiagio, you were at the time that he was president.
Yeah,
I was
working for him.
Okay. What was your job at that time?
I was vice president. I had the job that Jack Breslin had, and I'd been there 3 years or.
You were his assistant.
No,
initially,
Jack had died, and
okay,
I was vice president.
You took over after
for quite a long time. I don't remember the exact dates, but. But I'd worked with John and did all the legislative and PR work and got along really well with him.
I know one of the things in looking at his presidency that, or at least I understand that some of the reasons that he was brought was his ability to improve relations with the legislature, make sure our apportionment was, the money that we got from the state was good or better, and ability to rebuild those bridges. Did you have any role in that?
That wasn't John's forte.
Hmm.
John was a scholar, and he was really. In fact, he really had a priority on building development relationships, getting resources. He made some significant developments there. And he was very supportive, but as far as running the PR and the legislature, I had that almost free-handed at that time. And of course, he was the one place that he always seemed to find a challenge was the trustees at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, a lot of it focused on what he believed, and probably he was right that the university should be run by the president, not the director of athletics, and that's where he got into conflict with the board and led eventually to his move, not at their commitment, but he just decided that there was a greater, better life at Tufts, and he's done very, very well.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a perfect institution for him,
because
he's good with that kind of people.
It's interesting, the interplay at the university since entering the Big Ten, the importance of athletics. Could you talk a little bit about that? Are you a fan? What have you followed? what sports?
Right now I'm tired.
You're tired.
I said to my wife, and she's been such a great supporter, but I said, and she just loves athletics, particularly basketball and hockey.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, you know, after a month of this intensive schedule, playoffs, you just have to be tired to think what those young men are. Mm-hmm. But, you know, athletics is a highway, if you use it correctly, to get to academic success. And I think Peter McPherson realizes that as well as John Hanna did, and I think John Hanna realized it better than any other president in the United States. Mm-hmm. He never would have made such a strong pitch to get us in the Big Ten. And everybody, the general public generally, ties that Big Ten to athletics, but I tie it 50% to our successes in academics. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I'm a firm believer that this year's success is a good example. This will do more, not as much, but more for the university and goodwill, budgets, visibility, and academics. And I'll bet you that President McPherson will find a way to capitalize on that.
Mm-hmm. Beats an athletic scandal, that's for sure.
Oh, well, it does, and you know, I remember so well one of my dear friends said when the chariot issue, he came in here and he said, God, I'm upset. I said, what's the matter? And he said, oh, God, he said, and he doesn't work for the university. He said, U of M gets all this visibility. He said, I just came through the airport in Detroit. He said, cripes. He said, they're selling memorabilia from U of M. That's about, that was after the Fab Five. And by the truckloads, and he said, the MSU stuff sits there. I said, he said, we just don't get the visibility. I said, hey, listen. I said, that's the power of athletics. I said, we get back into prominence. I said, it's true. And I had been running a little, and while I was director of ag, I did this. I had all 98 or whatever it is of the state fair, or the fairs in the counties. And I remembered during those, the highlights when we were so prominent there with the Bubba Smith era and you go to a fair and you'd see, particularly you're talking about rural land grant folks, and you'd see 4, 5, 6 caps of Spartans and T-shirts to every one of the U of M. Mm-hmm. Well, it'd gotten to where at county fairs, you were seeing 4 U of M T-shirts to everyone, and that's what he was upset about. So I said, you know, that's the power of athletics, mm-hmm. and nothing else. And he said, I can't believe it. So I said, well, he said, we ought to do something about it. I said, you got any ideas? So it wasn't more than a week he came here. I said, he had an idea. It wasn't my idea, it was his. I get some credit for it, but it was his. And Jim Goodhart's. And he said, well, we ought to have a chariot. He said, that's something that they can't copy. We're Spartans. Mm-hmm. And, well, having horses and all of the challenges. And so I threw that out to some folks over in administration. Some thought it was and Russ Malby, he'll tell you, he was the greatest proponent, and he's a great horseman. Mm-hmm. And he had, and so Russ pushed it really hard. And that's how the chariot was, and it was all goes back to the fact that U of M had such power as a result of their 4, 5, 8 years of success. And that just shows you, it's probably worth, I don't know how many million, but in sales of MSU products this year, mm-hmm. I'll bet we'll outsell U of M 2-1. Mm-hmm.
And we're on the wave right now.
We're on the wave. And that's why, and Peter will have more 3.8 scholars interested in this place. We'll have more applications and more good kids. And if he finds a way to capitalize on this with some kind of an academic forward motion type of thing, it's unbelievable. But most people don't realize. They think athletics are athletic. Hell, that's not the case at all.
Could we go back?
John Hanna really knew that.
He did. Could we go back to your year as president? Who do you think brought your name to the fore? How did you become president?
I have to tell you the story. I had been vice president and got along really well with the board and got them involved quite actively with the legislature, and I always tried to do my job and stay out of the way, and as I do now, and I believe that you should do that. And so there'd been all this commotion between John and the board. And so when he indicated abruptly that he was leaving, it left quite a void. So the chairman was the hog farmer down there at Southern Michigan.
Jack Shingleton?
No. He was chair then. Mm-hmm. I'll get it in a minute. Well, anyway, he called me and said, "We want you to consider to be interim president." I said, "Geez," I said, "I'm really not very excited about that." He said, "Well, we're having a board meeting." He said, "Don't say you wouldn't." And I said, "Well, I won't say I will." And so I said, "Mrs. Geyer and I are headed for the UP for our cabin tomorrow." And he said, "Where can I get you tomorrow?" I said, "Can't." He said, "Well, call at me about 1 o'clock. So I was wheeling along too. And I stopped, and it was just like this morning, colder than a pistol, and the wind was blowing, and I had a outside phone there along about Manistique, and I called and said, he said, "Mr. President, can you come back tomorrow?" I said, "No way." "And what's this Mr. President stuff?" He said, "Well, we voted this morning," and he said, we want you to announce it tomorrow." And he said, "Geez," I said, "I'm going to be in the brush, and Norma's with me." And so I said, "Well, maybe if I get up at 3:15 or so and drive to Escanaba, I can get an early plane and fly down back." Well, of all the things, it was the worst weather to leave my wife up there,
oh, no.
3 miles from in the brush. And I drove to Escanaba, flew down here, and flew back. In those 2 days, that all happened. And I sure didn't apply for it, but and so then we made the decision to move right over to Cowell's house rather than try and do it. And so we just, it all happened so fast that we just closed our house up for a year and moved over there, and that was a smart move. Mm-hmm. And we did things different.
More than just symbolic. I mean,
I had a great rapport, I think, with the students, and a great rapport with the board. Mm-hmm. And they'd had enough of that scrapping, and probably part of it was not my talents, but was their want for a more positive image. And so one case in point is, you know, the students, I wanted to capture their support. And so the senior class was diddling around looking for a project. They always support. So I had 3 or 4, and they were good ones, but I said, Cowell's house hadn't had any upgrading for a long time, and I said, I couldn't put state money into making that handicapper accessible, but I really felt strongly about it. So I said, "Why don't you guys vote for working with me, and I'll make the bathrooms, and if you gather, I don't know, what, $70,000-$80,000, I'll make the inside handicap accessible, and you make the outside." Well, if you remember, they did. They voted 16-1, I think it was. I said, "We're getting that sucker finished while I'm president and having them in here." And if you look, there's a plaque there that recognizes that class. And then I had a big open house for them, for the seniors and the handicappers. You can roll right in there now. And that should have been done a long time ago. Mm-hmm. But I had a lot of fun with the students. I enjoyed them, we made some significant progress, I think. And then I had the chance to be the catalyst for hiring Tom, so that wasn't all bad.
Okay.
But I knew Tom would be successful. But there again, you know, there was an awful lot of alums. "Oh, Jesus, we got to go out and get a named man. He hasn't had any hands-on head experience."
What did you see in him?
I saw that guy. Just what's happened is that he was a real personable family man, and I knew that he could do one thing like nobody else, and that's go into homes. And I'll say this: Joe Ferguson was very supportive too. Mm-hmm. He saw that, and go into homes and really recruit kids, mm-hmm. and that's proven his. I mean, he can. He's demonstrated he can coach too. He's mm-hmm. creative as they come, but. It's just like yesterday. The headlines today are he never lost his humility. And that's tough in that position. Mm-hmm. God, with all of the visibility and pressure, mm-hmm. not lose your humility is. Mm-hmm. And he's a typical land-grant, blue-collared mm-hmm. person.
You see the UP connection important in his upbringing?
The UP connection is important, but the important part of it is that it casts him in the light of a homey type, blue-collared family man. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you see, Loopy is always there. A lot of times the young daughter's there. Mm-hmm. And if you're sending this outstanding recruit to an institution where he's going to at least have that fatherly counsel, and this partnership that he plays up with Cleves is can't do anything but help him mm-hmm. with moms and dads that want to make sure their kid doesn't go astray.
Want some guidance.
Yeah.
Won't get lost at the mega university.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. What did your wife think about you taking the presidency?
Oh, I think after that night in the woods, I got back, I don't know what time it was, way in the morning. And Jesus, she'd been in there and it had been rain and lightning and excuse me a minute. Everything happened so fast that, and she was extremely supportive, and she enjoyed the year very much, I'm sure she wouldn't trade that for anything.
Mm-hmm. What, obviously the presidential debates occurred on campus while you were president. How were you involved in that?
You know, I suppose that this never been recorded at all. Almost.
That's what we're talking about.
I almost sunk the debate. What happened was that that debate was one of the most interesting procedures, and I have nothing but compliment for the group that we had and the committee that prepared our request and so forth, and then eventually won. But we never got around to sign the papers for the debate. And there was just so much, things happened so fast, and there was so much confusion, and this is no small project. Mm-hmm. So, and there was some rough edges, and so the everything was in order. And Wharton Center was all prepared, and I kept pushing for more kids.
And more students to attend.
Yeah,
they were shut out.
You know, I'd been with them, and they were talking about 20 or 30 kids, uh-huh. and they were ushers. And so it was just an absolute coincidence. It wasn't any of my great wisdom. But I went over to look at the place 2 days before, I think it was. And lo and behold, the press was out there, and they asked me some questions, and I said, I'm not sure there's going to be a debate. And he said, what? And I said, I'm thoroughly disenchanted with the fact that that the students have committed so much and have done so, are so interested, and I said, they ought to be a part of this historical development. Well, I got some press. And they wouldn't open up the upstairs there because of safety.
Security.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I said, that's nonsense. You know, and so anyhow, it wasn't long until we got, I don't know how many more, but we got 100 or more kids in there, and we got some handicappers in that we wouldn't have gotten in, and the whole attitude changed. But you know, it was wrong. Mm-hmm. Lord, if you're going to have it on a campus, kids, that's once in a lifetime. Mm-hmm. And then it was a fascinating, because somebody said, well, you want to welcome Bush? And I said, sure. And I said, the last time I was with him was in China, and he had just, I had taken the first group of entomologists over in 1975 or 4, and it was just the time I was changing over to director of extension, but I took and it was a fascinating thing. He was, and his wife had just arrived, not as ambassador, because they didn't have an ambassador, but as a liaison person. And he could only travel, I don't know, 25 or 30 miles around Beijing. And we had pretty much a run of the country, and we were there a month or more. And so he had us, when we got there, over to this very modest house. And so he said, you know, I'd like to meet with you fellows when you get back to learn what you've seen. So we said, sure. And I was chairman of the group, so we decided during the month that we'd have a nice thank you for the Chinese, and we got back to Beijing, and we decided we'd have it at the Sichuan restaurant rather than the famous Beijing restaurant, than the Peking restaurant where the Peking duck was so famous, and because we all liked that hot food. And so we invited him, in that 4 weeks, he'd learned quite a few words and phrases, and they loved that. They loved him.
Mm-hmm.
So he said it was a great evening, and we had the dishes, is almost all of them had some insect name in it.
Mm-hmm.
Ants crawling up and down the noodles and all of this. You know, they weren't all insects, but the names were. And he loved that. And the Chinese, you know, the fact that we went a little bit out of the normal diplomatic, they liked that.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then Perry Atkinson, who eventually became the chancellor of Texas A&M and an entomologist, knew him. And so as we were breaking up that night, he said, anything you guys need, you got it. We had another 4 or 5 days. Perry said, kind of just a joke, he said, yeah, we ran out of whiskey a couple of 3 nights ago. And he laughed. And so the next morning we got up, and the cars were waiting, and we looked, and there was a box of American whiskey that he'd sent over. And so he came in the back of the Wharton Center with the security folks, and this guy and I was there, and I said, you probably don't remember me, do you? And I said, Gordon Guyer, last time I saw you, you hosted us with the entomology group in China. He said, you were with Perry Atkinson, and you ran out of whiskey. So, you know, that was so that's 74 to whatever the was.
93.
It was almost 20 years, and he remembered that one thing. But anyway, it was a great event for the university, I think, you know.
Did they have a reception or anything where you met Ross Perot and President candidate?
The three, that was one of the things we did extremely well with the security thing was our folks, they said we did the best job organizing, and they did. And also, that's typical, but we knew how to do it. That was part of our extension heritage.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the PR and the security and, you know, you didn't see any rough edges to that project.
Mm-hmm.
It was done well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the picture there,
you've got signatures on there, too?
You forget about those things. Yeah.
Anything else during your term in office were highlight?
I hope that you
or low light or whatever.
I hope at what you are doing here that you look carefully. We've talked a lot about the changes here on the campus and the changes and decisions that relate around people, but certainly, we need desperately to make sure we keep our eye on capturing the historical significance of the changes since 1855. But case in point, I do quite a little bit of hunting, as you know, and I go down here by Flint to a pheasant preserve to keep my dog sharp. And this guy that runs this is a farmer who's turned his farm into this, and he's a graduate, forget the exact year, but he's 80 years old, plus or minus. And his dad was a graduate in 1889. And there was 19 in his class, and there was one lady. And last time I was down, God, he went to the safe and pulled out the whole list and the yellow. I said, my God, man, that's worth it. And then we got to talking. He's got three grandchildren here now, and that makes four generations. And
at the university.
Yeah, right. And 13 of his relatives have all graduated from Michigan State. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, this is the kind of thing, and of course, he's gone from that's one of the areas where metropolitan development is encroached on, so he's turned his farm into a profitable shooting preserve. Well, what I'm saying is we desperately need to make sure that we maintain first our land-grant heritage. There's something unique about land-grant. I felt a little bit uneasy that we don't see it on the sign anymore. The new signs you put up, there's no reverence to the fact that, and that makes us not only different, but different in a very positive way. And it doesn't have anything to do with agriculture. That just happened to be how it originated. But you know, I think Peter's so absolutely right in expanding the horizons of these kids with priorities for internships, international travel. The world's getting so small. John Hanna would be pleased. He saw that in 1945, and to me, we not only must capture the history and the implications of our land grant responsibility, and it shows up in everything we do. But we need to make sure the next century it continues, because that's the only thing that separates us creatively and uniquely. And it's part of our serving people. That's all it is. It's not a matter of us serving farmers. It's a matter of whether you're in medicine, we're serving people with primary care, whether you're in business, and we're out there helping people establish and run better businesses, and not just training kids in the classroom. So, you know, I worry. That's why I think historians have got a great opportunity to, one, not only capture what was the past, but keep us on the course for the future.
Mm-hmm. Well, what was the name of the person that had the hunting preserve?
His name is Harold. Gosh darn it!
I didn't mean to.
Yeah, I'll have to get you that.
Okay, but he sounds like he'd be
Be a gem to.
Yeah, especially trying to capture some of the student perspective.
Oh
which
yeah.
We want to try to.
Yeah,
do.
You know, it's a case study. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I'll think of some other good names for you too. Mm-hmm. As I go along now, I know exactly what you're doing. Mm-hmm. As I run into people and I think, oh man, somebody should talk to them.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's again.
And I hope you continue your interest in this kind of maintaining, because you see, as I said, it's a cream. It's just a shame that. We hadn't had somebody that recaptured the Renaissance, the rise and fall of the whole pesticide era. Mm-hmm. The Michigan State was so prominent in there. Mm-hmm. And that I mentioned Bob Ball.
Several that we should talk
about. Yeah, yeah. And you're on the right track.
One last question deals with the issue of maybe loyalty. Why did you stay at Michigan State University and it seems as if many of the people we've been talking with, Walter Adams, mm-hmm. Another is an example who came here, anticipated staying a year or two and then leaving, but your whole career. Why did you stay at Michigan State?
Yeah, well, I stayed, one, because I was having such a good time and enjoying professionally what I was doing. And it would have been more profitable, probably. And you know, I might have been more successful if I'd have jumped when some of these offers came along, but I was really intrigued with what I was doing. Secondly, you know, the university was such a great place, so creative, in the areas that I wanted. And, you know, I didn't need to go to industry or somewhere because I was getting so satisfied and so interested here. And I personally had now look back and realize that I really believed in the land grant of serving people. Mm-hmm. And so that fit well, you know, whether I was out there with the legislature or whether, and building friends. And so it was just what my personality meshed with and my interests meshed with. And one thing fell in line, and as I told you, you know, it's kind of nice to be able to say that you never had a day you didn't want to get to office, and you never applied for anything you got involved with. So I was just a very fortunate person. And, you know, I still keep my interest, but I have a firm belief that once you're finished with a job, whether it was presidency or director of Department of Ag, or I still stay interested in all the subject matter, but I stay away. I told Peter that, you know, my philosophy is, if you ever want me, I'm over in the Kellogg Center, but I'm too close to the campus involvement of the politics that I want to get.
Well, I want to thank you very much for your time. Well, I appreciate your contributions to the Oral History Project.
I can see that Fred did well with you, and and you know, we've had some great ones like Madison and others, but we've really lost some of that. And to finish answering your last question, which I intended and I got off base, one of the things that bothers me in addition.